Welcome to the Overdrive Outdoors Podcast,
your source for everything outdoors.
Let's kick it into overdrive.
Overdrive Outdoors Podcast, brought to you by Predator Hunter Outdoors. Whether you are new to predator hunting or looking to upgrade your equipment, Predator Hunter Outdoors will have you hunting after the sun goes down. Carrying a full line of lights, night vision, and thermal optics, along with tripods, calls, mounting systems, and more, check them out at www.predatorhunteroutdoors.com or on Facebook at Predator Hunter Outdoors. Use promo code OVERDRIVE2021 for 20% off your order. Want to lengthen your time in the field and shorten your scouting time? Not only does the HuntWise app show you property boundaries, landowners' names, and in some cases even their phone number, but using the app will show you the wind direction on the map of the place you want to hunt. And the HuntCast feature shows peak movement times for various species, including predators. Get the HuntWise app at www.huntwise.com, the Google Play Store, or the Apple App Store. For only $59.99 a year for Pro or $119.99 a year for Elite. Use promo code OVERDRIVE20 for 20% off an annual membership.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Overdrive Outdoors Podcast. This week's episode is going to be hosted once again by Kevin Rott. He's going to be joined by Carl Roller, and they're going to be talking to Mark Earle of the Michigan Trappers and Predator Callers Association. Mark tells us a little bit about the role he plays in the MTPCA. He talks about how they're helping fight for our rights. They go into good discussion about the wolf hunt that we were wanting to have this year, how fur sales work, fur auctions. And this week we're asking you, the listener, a specific question with a chance to win some Overdrive logo wear. So this week's question is going to be, what is the date and location of the next fur sale through the MTPCA? If you can send us a message, the first one, we're going to send you something Overdrive. Thank you all for listening. Everybody take care. Let's get into this episode with Carl, Kevin, and Mark Earle.
Hey, everybody. Kevin Rott here today, joined by Carl Roller and our special guest, Mark Earle from Michigan Trappers and Predator Callers Association. How you doing today, guys?
Good.
Fantastic. Doing great today. How about yourself?
Doing well. Had to work a little bit this weekend, but since I got out of work, the weather's been nice other than the wind, so trying to take a little bit of advantage of it.
Got to when you can, you know.
Right. So Michigan Trappers and Predator Callers Association has been in place since, what, roughly 1957.
Okay. Yep. Started out as a Zone 2 Michigan Trappers is what we started out as.
And how long have you been involved with the organization?
I've been involved, I wish I actually knew the year. I'm not sure what year it was. Approximately 12 or 15 years I've been involved, but not at a high level. Sometime around maybe 2010, 2011, I started getting more involved.
Okay. And you're current... Go ahead.
About the time they started to want to take away the rights to use conibear bear traps, you know, I kind of got more involved. I realized that the association was actually doing a lot to try to protect that right, especially on private property. And I decided I should probably step up and do my part.
And your current role is public relations, right?
That's correct.
And as such, what do you do for MTCPA in that role?
Oh, I do things like this right here. I talk to people about the association. I do demos. I do different things with like the legislature. We have sometimes we have meetings with the legislator. There's Legislative Sportsman's Caucus. They'll have like a breakfast, and occasionally we'll like host a breakfast, and then I get a chance to stand up there and give a presentation in front of maybe 30 people who are making laws in Michigan, and I can tell them what it is we do and why we do it. So it's an opportunity to tell what we do.
Okay. How many members does MTCPA currently have, do you know?
We're always somewhere right around 1,000.
Really, I'm surprised it's that low.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not bad numbers, but with the number of sportsmen we have in the state, I kind of thought it would have been higher.
Yep, that's true. And, you know, we are a member association of the Michigan United Conservation Club also. So when somebody's a member with the MTPCA, you're also a member with MUCC. And that a lot of people don't realize what that means. Mm-hmm. When you're a member of MUCC, you actually have a voice in what they're fighting for in the state.
Okay. And I was going to say, really, it's not, I mean, it only costs like what, $25 a year or something to be a member?
Yeah. Yes.
And that includes like a magazine subscription, right?
If you want to get the magazine, you have to pay a little more for that to pay for the magazine. You know, okay. We send out like a newsletter four times a year about things that are going on and, you know, fur sales, things like that are some of the benefits, you know.
You guys were running, when I was up there and I met you, you guys were running a deal, wasn't it? It was like $100, but you also got multiple, well, I don't know if it was $100, but you guys were giving a deal. You got to be part of like three different groups or something like that. Is that?
Yeah. Sometimes we do promotions with the National Trappers Association and the Fur Takers of America. We do things where if you become a member, you know, it's, you can become a member of them also inexpensively. So we occasionally do programs like that.
Which helps us all. Obviously, I do both sides of the world. So for me, this is definitely helpful for both ends of, you know, calling and trapping, as well as Kevin does too. I know you, so.
And it's especially right now, to me, it seems like anybody that can join one of these organizations really should. I mean, we're, the industry or the community itself seems to be under attack more so than ever, especially with the advent of social media. And I know from personal experience that MTCPA gets involved from, like you were saying earlier, a legislative standpoint, meeting with the lawmakers, working with MUCC. I know we dealt with you guys a lot when we were working on getting the center fire at night passed. So the bigger the membership we have in something like that, the more it benefits us as sportsmen, and especially in trapping and predator calling, because both of those seem to be pretty active targets for the antis right now.
Absolutely. That's definitely a fact. And yeah, you know, I was talking about the MUCC, and when we go to their convention every year, we have a couple of delegates, myself and Chris Kettler will be there this year. And all the policy resolutions that they have before them, people bring these ideas out. This is what we'd like to see the MUCC campaign to do in the legislature and things, what kind of laws we want to see. And that goes through a voting process. And the more members we have as the MTPCA, the more votes we have. It's based on how many. And so when it's going around the room to vote, I raise my hand up with my three delegates. If I had five, that might make a difference in the vote. And now what you have is all the conservation clubs in Michigan. You have the Wild Turkey Federation people. You have the Ducks Unlimited, Trout Unlimited. All these different groups are there voting on things that could affect us. So it's real important for us to develop relationships with these other sporting organizations.
Absolutely. Now, you guys are heavily involved in the conventions as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, conventions. We do. That's one of the biggest things we do in the summertime.
I know I've been making the one up in Everett. I think I've only missed one out of the past 3 or 4 years, and I always have a good time up there. I mean, it's the people up there are great to deal with. They're like-minded. A lot of good deals on supplies if you want to buy them. A lot of good vendors there. There's demos there. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff to actually do, even for kids, adults, and everything.
Yep, absolutely. And one of the big focuses I've had lately, myself personally, I want to take an interest in this, is promoting predator calling. In 2009, we became the trappers and predator callers. And it's been hard to get a foothold. Trying to get somebody to do a demo at the convention has been difficult over the past several years until this past year. In 2021, we had some great demos. And I think that people really appreciated that. The people that want to see and talk to people who are doing some of the good caliber predator calling.
I know Eric Trombley did one. You did one with Matt, right, Mark or Carl?
Yeah.
And then yes. I did one with Matt as well, and we seem to get good feedback off it.
It's only going to grow from there. You know, once the word spreads that, hey, you know, I can go there and I can talk to these guys. I can see their setup. I can see what they're doing. people are going to want to come and see that. I know they will.
Well, that's why I know that's why Josh in our group, he was starting to put up another camera to talk about and show how we set up, how we do it. So you can physically watch us while we're hunting out there. So people can see how it's happening, what we're doing, what there is out there, not just, oh man, do I have to hide in a tree line or do I have to hide here? What do I do? A lot of these people are asking a lot of questions. And for us, that's kind of where Josh was going. But
now, would you say the number of trappers from what you guys see, is that seem to be staying steady? Or are they kind of dropping off? Are we gaining people?
Trapping comes and goes a little bit, but it actually has stayed pretty steady. I mean, we've seen about the same number of members, same number of people, you know, trapping typically. Most places I go, there's somebody trapping on the property. You know, it's not like it's gone away entirely, but it will surge with the fur prices. If the fur prices go up, you're going to see people competing a lot more.
Yep, and that's one thing I was going to mention is that with fur prices being kind of in the tank the past couple of years, I kind of wondered if it dropped off a little bit. But, I mean, the guys that do it hardcore, I know like Carl, he's been probably doing it longer than I have, and a few of the other people I know out there, the hardcore guys do it. They don't care about the fur prices. I mean, they're doing it because they love doing it.
Absolutely. That's why I do it. I'm not making money on this. I mean, I'd probably get a little better return on my investment than a deer hunter would.
Other than meat in the freezer, most trappers don't get too much of that.
Well, you'd be surprised.
Well, I know that, you know, guys like to eat beaver. I've heard of people eating muskrat, but aside from that, maybe coon here and there. I don't hear about too many other fur bears that are part of a regular diet.
Cats.
I eat cat, but I bet you there's not too many people that actually do.
No, I mean, obviously, again, when we can only trap one down here and one in the UP, it's like a delicacy. You get this little itty bitty piece of meat. And
right.
And most people get theirs mounted. Like I can see in the back of Mark's screen here, he's got one mounted. Most people get it mounted. So what happens if the taxidermist gets them and then he just takes it for the most part, because it's been sitting on the carcass for so long that he just throws the meat out back. So it really doesn't get that great, but I don't know. I have mine in my freezer and I plan on eating it, trying it. I hear it's kind of like pork is from what I was told.
Very much so.
Exactly.
So, Mark, what would you say is the most popular animal that people target in Michigan? Would you say, is it tend to be predators? Is it beaver? Is it water animals?
If you look at the sales we have at our auction, the highest number every year is going to be muskrats, because a muskrat trapper is going to catch higher numbers. Maybe like a beaver trapper. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't see people catching 2,000 beavers in a year or coyotes, but they can go out there and do that with muskrats. So as far as the numbers caught, it's probably muskrats.
You got to take karate out of it, though. As soon as you take Zach karate out of the question, the numbers start to come a little bit more into reality. But
yeah, he's a machine.
So now I remember my question. My question was going to be, since we're talking about bobcats, recently, there's an email put out by the DNR that they were looking at doing some expansion on our bobcat season here in Michigan. Was MTCPA involved in that?
Absolutely. Yeah, we would love to have it over the entire state if it's feasible. We don't ever want to trap or shoot animals if they're not gonna, you know, if there's not enough of them in the area. We're a conservation organization. We want to maintain the resource. So if there's not enough here, we don't really want to have a season on them, but everybody in Southern Michigan is catching them, except myself. I don't see any in my trapping area. I've never seen a bobcat track where I trap, but I know people 20 miles from me that have been seeing a lot of them. In South, I know people who've trapped, you know, five of them in Jackson County, that kind of thing.
Well, I know on our fur harvester survey that we get every year, I've actually been filling that out and responding back to it, that they need to bring down that line below Muskegon County, or at least to Muskegon County, because as a caller, even I've called in a lot of cats in Muskegon County. Usually they're out of season and obviously I can't do anything about it with them in Muskegon County anyway, but I'm at the northern part, so I'm not far from Oceana County where they can legally be hunted and trapped. But like I said, I've called a lot in Muskegon County, and it's kind of nice to see that forward movement to allow us to hunt some in this area. I mean, even right by where I live, some of the community Facebook pages, we get people on there. It's like, oh my gosh, I seen a bobcat, hide your cats, hide your dogs, you know, all that stuff. And it's nice. I hope they do expand that, because I think the opportunity will be there for people to be successful in those areas and the longer season.
Don't feel too bad, Mark. Today I was checking the line, and this is here in Kent County, and about every 2 days I got a bobcat coming through in a spot, and I'm praying that they open it, because he's been there, or she has been there, because the landowner seen kits. So we know that there's a pair running around, and now they've got kits running around. But every 2 days they come through a spot that the coyotes were running down the trail, and I was going to start snaring. And then all of a sudden the bobcat started running down. So I realized that it's probably not a good spot for a snare. I mean, it was, I could get them, but I'd get the bobcat and then I'd be in trouble. But so today I checked the line, and sure enough, bobcat went right down the trail again. And you just kind of look and go, well, hopefully they open it for us next year. So
I have to say, that's probably my favorite animal to catch, the bobcat. I get more of a thrill out of catching them than anything else, and seeking them. And I can't do that around where I'm at, so I have to travel to do it. But I can't wait till the day I can actually catch them here where I trap.
Now, this year, you guys take a trip to Kansas every year, correct?
Yeah.
This year, you guys were successful?
I didn't get a bobcat this year, but Joel Velchansky got his first bobcat that he could keep. He has caught bobcats in Michigan, but he couldn't keep them because there's not a season in the area he traps either. But he went out there with me, and he was able to catch a really beautiful cat. Brought that home.
Did you figure out how much that weighed?
I don't know how much it weighed. It wasn't a large one, but it was very, very well spotted. One of the best cats I've seen.
Nice. Tomer or female?
It's a female.
Okay. Which is not typical for spots.
We talked about that before. Remember, we were talking about what they actually call a female bobcat. You remember that?
Yeah, I remember. You asked me too, and it was a queen or something, wasn't it?
Queen. Yeah. A male is called a tom, and a female is called a queen. That baffled me, but now we know.
Yeah, that's awesome. The first one I caught is actually the one right there beside me. And I misjudged the sex on it. I told the conservation officer when I was at the tailgate, you know, I told him it was a female, and he said, I thought you said this was a female. I thought it was. I looked down, and yeah, sure enough, it wasn't. They kind of hide their gender a little better than maybe a dog will.
You're not the only one that's done that, Mark. I did that this year. I checked the cat in the field, and I looked at it, and I said, well, it looked like a male. And then I went to my taxidermist, and we're skinning it, and he's like, well, where's the anatomy to say that's a male, you know? And then we got looking, and I'm like, maybe it is a female. And then finally figured out, I think Carl actually sent me a picture that helped me determine for sure what it was. My initial assessment was right, but I was confused there for a couple of minutes. What other species do you trap, Mark?
I'm kind of a jack of all trades and the master of none. I like to trap a little bit of everything. Anything I can trap in my area, I will. I don't want to have a huge number of muskrats. If I can catch muskrats and raccoons or mink, you know, I'd like to just kind of get a broad brush out there.
Which is fun. It gives you different avenues to go. You know, you can trap different areas, different styles, different, and have fun, you know, going out into the wild and enjoying yourself, trying to get any animal to step in that 1-inch spot in the entire world. And by being able to do, like you said, you can basically pick what you're after and go after them. You may not be, which I think you're still great, but you may not be the greatest, but you're still able to do it. And what I enjoy about it is teaching. I may not be the greatest either, but I enjoy teaching people about it. And that's the advantage.
You find a specific animal, you're trying to catch that one. You got the one otter coming through, and you know he's the best teacher, because he's gonna teach you everything not to do.
And, no, he's just like Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, otters is one of the big success stories. At one time, there weren't otters here, and they've actually made a huge rebound because of trapping them and re-releasing them in a lot of places where they used to roam. And now there's otters all over Michigan. And at one time, you know, we could only get one in southern Michigan here where I'm at. Now you can get two. I mean, so they're actually becoming a little bit more liberal with the permits because they know the population is getting to that level. And that's where bobcat will be.
I talked to a biologist one year. I asked him, I said, are we ever going to get two otters down here? We see them all the time on the Grand, on the Rogue, the Flat. Around me, there's a bunch of these major rivers. How do we get above them? Well, he said the problem that they were having was the Grand, the Muskegon, they're heavily filled with otters. The population is doing well. They're growing. He said the problem with the southern zone was the Kalamazoo River, and the southern rivers were so polluted that they said, he told me that they weren't actually even reproducing. The babies were only making it 2 weeks to a month, and then they would die. But now I know that they've been doing a lot of cleanups down there. And I actually just talked to a buddy who is now trapping the Kalamazoo, and he has quite a whole family flying around there, and he's going to try for his first otter here with very limited time remaining, but he's going to try for it and see if he can get one. So like you said, it's a pretty good success rate, or a pretty success story that they're finally coming back.
I would like to just see one in the wild. I've never seen an otter in the wild.
Yeah, it's amazing.
They are an ADD animal that basically is just running around. It's a weasel, and that's the neat thing. Just like martens and fishers up in the UP, there's no rhyme or reason. It's, ooh, squirrel. Like, let's go over here. Oh, let's go over here. You can't really pattern them down, but they're so curious. That's why, like, martin and fisher trapping is, like, I was taught, just, you don't have to just go find sign and put it on sign, because as soon as they see something new, they have to go investigate it. It's kind of the same thing with otters. Ooh, something new. Let's go look at that. And then they do.
So what kind of things are going on with MTCPA right now? They got anything in the works that you can talk about?
Well, trying to figure out the fur market. That's all going on right now. You know, we just had a fur sale a couple of weeks ago, and we had a lot more fur there than I thought we were going to, especially when it started. We had 12 buyers there buying fur. The prices were better maybe than they had been in previous sales. A lot of the buyers were buyers looking to do the craft thing. They're trying to make hats and gloves out of them, not maybe a person going to send them up to Canada into the fur market, but people are trying to utilize the fur in other ways. And so a lot of these buyers there were there for that purpose. And so just trying to figure out how many fur sales should we have each year? How many people are going to show up and want to sell their fur? How many furs are going to be there? And we're trying to refine that process. We used to have 5 every year, and they were long all day, almost 2-day sales. I mean, they start early in the morning and late at night. Now it's not like that. Now, you know, there's not as many people selling fur.
For someone that's never been there, can you describe how the fur sale works?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the best thing to do is to get a lot number ahead. You can talk to the fur sale director and get a number. It's a $5. If you're a member, you pay a $5 lot price to have your number. And then when they get to your number, you have all your furs on the table. At this point, you've already went through and put tags on them all and you filled out the paperwork and stuff. And there's people there to help you with that before you sell. But then as your number comes up, you slide your furs out along the table in front of the buyers, and they have an auctioneer, and he's auctioning them just like you would at a state auction. It's actually a pretty fascinating thing. And we'll have one more in Gaylord in March. I don't know the date off the top of my head. It's late in March, 25th, something like that. It's on our website. Anybody that wants to know anything about selling fur, if they go there, they get to see it all happen. It's exciting.
And when they sell furs at these fur sales, are these furs all, I mean, what's the condition of the fur? I mean, they aren't tanned already, right?
No tanned fur. Well, actually, I've seen one once, but these are all dried furs.
Okay.
Well, not all dried furs. Most of them are dried furs. You can sell the carcass fur. You can just bring a whole muskrat laid on the table, and they will sell it that way.
Oh, wow.
You can bring a skinned animal. They call that green or in the grease, mm-hmm. where you've skinned it, but you never finished it. And, you know, they're limp. They're thawed out so they can look at them good. Or you can sell them like a finished fur where it's skinned and fleshed and dried.
Now, the people that come and buy the furs, are they, because I know some of the fur market was overseas for quite a while, like Russia and China. The people that come to these to buy the furs, are they like agents, so to speak, where they're here to buy for other countries, or is it all domestic?
Yeah, they get orders. You know, I talk to the fur buyers and they tell me they got an order. You know, they need to get a lot of coyotes this year, or they need to get a lot. You know, I got an order for a bunch of beavers. So they're working out deals with somebody overseas or maybe in Canada.
Okay.
To sell a bigger lot of fur. And so they're trying to hit a certain number, you know, to meet the demand of the vast of them. Then there's other guys who are just small guys just buying fur to try to resell it, and other ones that want to make something out of it.
So to that point, why do you think is driving down the fur prices right now?
Well, I mean, you nailed it when you said China and Russia. That's the two biggest markets, and we're not really getting along that well with them right now.
Right.
The one factor is that our furs go to Canada. You know, the big auction houses are up there. Big auction house, used to be a couple of them, though. NAFA is no longer, so Fur Harvesters is the place everybody's going. But the international buyers come there, and they're not really dealing with the U.S., they're dealing with Canada. So that is beneficial for us. But, you know, obviously, I'm going to blame COVID.
So now going back to you guys being more involved in the caller side of things, I'm assuming that the organization itself probably has more trappers than they do callers, but as you know, Carl and I know, and probably you know as well, calling is growing exponentially almost everywhere, but especially in Michigan because our populations are up and more people see it and thinks it looks like fun. And you can do it almost year round, so they're going out and doing it. What kind of things does MTCPA have that they're working on for callers?
Well, one of the biggest things is, like I said, the convention. We want to really make sure we hit that group of people. We want to make sure we have something that they want to see. And in order to do that, we have to talk to people who are doing that. Myself, I'm a trapper, and I do a little bit of calling, but I've never even once called at night. I don't have any equipment to do that, and I've never jumped into that realm. I really don't need another hobby right now, but but I'm still interested in that. But all the people who are making that their big priority, I want to have something there for them. I want to have demos, and I want to have people who are selling the types of equipment they want there. You know, that's a big part of that. And then the other part is the legislative. When something comes up on the docket that needs to be talked about, lately a lot of that has been calling issues. You know, we're going to call it calling contests, right? That's been a big hot button item for the antis. And they don't like that. And I just can't understand their logic, but I guess they don't have a lot of logic when it comes to that. And we're there to support that. And we want to be a part of that. We're going to be at the contest this coming up weekend on Sunday. I'm going to be up there. I'll have a little booth set up, talk to people. I'm going to probably get about 10 minutes to talk to some people about what it is we do. I'll have some fur there. I got a nice coyote fur that I shot with my 30 cal twice with hollow points. And I sewed it back together. It's a beautiful pelt for the wall. And I'd like to show the guys, you know, even if you put holes in them, you can make it look like this, you know. So
yeah, that's,
I just want to make sure.
I think Josh was just talking about one other day he shot that he was concerned about the hole in it, but after he skinned it out, he said it wasn't as bad as he thought it was. That was a pretty blonde.
Yeah. Yeah, one time I went down to Oklahoma and we shot some pigs and we put the pigs out in the field, and sure enough, the coyotes came in just like clockwork. And my buddy, we came around the corner and we were like 50 yards from these coyotes on the pig. And he shot it with a 204. And boy, he put a hole in that thing so big that we thought this was worthless. This isn't going to do anything, but hey, you shot a coyote, right? Down in Oklahoma. So we brought it back to the landowner and we showed him, and he was a big trapper. That's how we kind of met him. And we showed him what we're going to do. And we said, ah, man, this thing really isn't worth doing anything with. And it was really goofy. I've never seen a coyote like this, but it was from the butt to the nose was only like 2 feet, 3 feet long, but it had long legs like a normal, like it was just this pig style, just this little itty bitty thing, but it had long legs and just deformed. And thought, man, this is really cool, but what do you do with it? And we just kind of left it there. He said, well, go off to my other property and go see if you can shoot some pigs. So we went out and we came back that night. And sure enough, he had sowed this hole that was bigger than a softball. And he sowed it and he made it look so nice. And it looked like there was no damage done. And he goes, what are you talking about? What hole? You know, and he said, if you know how to use a piece of thread and a needle, he said, you can make anything look good, you know. I was pretty impressed. Now that fox Chris shot during the tournament the other day, that one, there's no saving that one. But it happens. So
I know one of our other guys, Jeremy Kennedy, is a taxidermist, and I know there's been times too where he's got people bring in coyotes to him that they shot like during deer season. And he says, yeah, this guy shot this one with a 300 Win Mag, or this one was shot with a 30-06. And I tell you what, by the time he's done with them, you can't tell that. You know, they do a pretty darn good job. It's impressive sometimes the work that a good taxidermist or someone that's just good with a needle and thread can fix.
Or even a Rage broadhead.
Right. That might be a little bit easier. It's a nice clean cut.
Clean, yeah.
So I know recently they had a couple changes to predator calling laws in Michigan. We had where you can now hunt at night from an elevated platform, tree stand. They also made it, I believe, so you can hunt cats from a tree stand. Is that right?
I don't know for sure. I don't want to comment on it because I don't know the answer. So.
Okay. Well, I do know that they made it so you can hunt from an elevated stand at night more. And I thought there was another one too that was recently passed. I know Bob Abbott's been working on them a lot. And those were changes that were made to this 2021 game laws. And that's one thing we see a lot on our page and some of the other predator hunting social media pages is people asking questions about, you know, what can you do, what can't you do, especially the different firearm restrictions in the limited rifle zone and up here. I seen one guy even posted, I think it was yesterday, posted on there, can you still hunt coyotes in Michigan during denning season? So it's interesting, you know, we try and steer people towards the guides so that they have the most accurate information. We do have a graphic that was put together by Mitchell McEachern, which breaks down a lot of that stuff, makes it easy for people to see. But it's just, you know, people need to take the time to read the guide. You know, I mean, it's easy. If you can be on a phone and post to Facebook, you can download the guide and read it all right on your phone or on your PC. So that's one thing we really try to encourage people to do is go ahead and read those guides and read them every year because stuff changes. One of the other hot topics right now is the wolf situation. So they were working towards, at least we were working towards, getting a wolf season. The DNR seemed to be really dragging their feet on it, even though from what I understand, they had the stuff in place to set a season. Then they got put back under federal protection again by a judge out in California. One thing I'm seeing a lot of people ask, and you know, if you don't know the answer to this, that's fine, but how is it that a judge in California can affect the hunting laws in Michigan?
The key word you said is federal. Things like the Endangered Species Act is a federal thing, and that would take a precedent. You know, a state can't. But kind of like you think about geese, there's a lot more to do with geese than just the DNR. Anything that's migratory, you got a lot of other states involved with that because, you know, one state can't just take all that resource, you know. But with the Endangered Species Act, that's very sacred. It's something that's really hard to get by, and it's been a good thing for our country, but now they're trying to use that to their advantage and you know, we don't appreciate that. It's not being used correctly.
So is that a quote unquote battle that MTCPA is going to try and help out with, is trying to get that overturned?
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely.
From a standpoint of the hunters and trappers in the state, what could we do to help?
You have to call your representatives. That's a big factor right there. Call the people who are making the laws. They should know your name. They should be tired of hearing from you.
Okay.
You want to make a difference, talk to those people. Talk to your your federal reps, not just the state people, because the people that run the country are the ones that are making the laws that affect that. And there will be some type of fight. We're gonna try to do what we can to fight that. It's a hard thing to do with the endangered species. You know,
it's hard when they're taken off the endangered species list. You know, they were completely, they're at that point of being able to reproduce. They're able to be above the threshold. Me personally, going to the UP and Martin and Fisher trapping, I see them daily. You know, I don't see them physically. I see the tracks. I see them every day on the roads I'm running. They're there. They're around. I just don't understand how, like, our area is considered differently than, like, Idaho. You know, Idaho can still hunt them over there in Montana, but we're separate, and then they can just make a law in California that has no recollection, or not recollection, but no point of anything to do with us. They don't even have our wolves, yet they can tell us from another country, another state, hey, you can't do that over there, what you're doing, just because we don't like what you're doing. It almost is no different than them saying, hey, we don't like you trapping. Us in California don't like people in Michigan trapping. You're done trapping now. It kind of is on that same wavelength. And I mean, I know I'm just preaching to the choir here, but it seems unfair that someone else in another state can tell me what I can and can't do here.
I couldn't agree with you more, Carl. It's not right. I don't understand why it has to be that way, but I don't have the answer, honestly. All we can do is try to fight it.
One thing that Mike Avery, we follow him quite a bit and watch his shows on his radio show. He talked about names of people that were involved in getting the wolves put back on the endangered species list. And one thing that he mentioned, and I've heard Bob mention it and a couple other people, is the representatives that HSUS or PETA have at our meetings talking about the wolf situation and presenting their side of it, to the point of almost threatening the people in our state with, you know, you don't know who you're dealing with, or we have such and such a backing. And I mean, it just seems kind of, for lack of a better word, very aggressive on how they're going after these issues.
You throw enough stuff at the wall, eventually it's going to stick. That's their tactic. They just keep going. And I think COVID was pretty bad about that. For our Natural Resources Commission meetings, once COVID hit and there was no longer in person, the lawyers in New York could get on the list and talk to our NRC refs, and right, they were plugging it up. It was easy then. They didn't have to travel.
Right. Yeah, we've listened to a couple of the ones that they had virtually, and that's one thing. I got a buddy at work that he gets a little bit more opportunity of listening to them than I do, and he told me, so, man, you need to listen to that, because they had such and such on there from, you know, different state or, you know, different organization. He said, man, you need to listen to what they're saying, because it ain't good.
You know, in the past, they've had different petitions, signature drives and things. And I remember going into Flint where they had a meeting before their petition was actually out. And I went in there and listened to their speeches, and I listened to them trying to train the people on how to gather signatures and how to do it effectively. And I actually got a copy of the petition. They didn't know me from Adam. They thought I was just some guy there interested in being an anti-hunter, I guess. And I come out with that. And then we stood out there and protested with signs. And I was able to get that petition out to people that, you know, wanted to know what was going to be on there. So we're trying to get a jump on them, you know. So we're always trying to do something, trying to understand what they're trying to do.
And I guarantee they're doing the same thing the other way, but you have to, right? I mean, it's a bunch of dirty tricks, it seems like, a lot of times. And for the most part, from what I see, there's a lot of great outdoorsmen out there. They do everything ethically. They're putting the animal down as fast as they can. They're putting the traps the right way to make them effective to be kill traps, or, you know, most traps like footholds are designed to actually hold the animal, not hurt the animal. That's what they're trying to do. Obviously, there's always a few bad apples, just like in politics, just like in the doctors, every world there's bad people, but it seems like, I don't know, they're after everyone because they just group everybody in with these mean killers that are out there, and really it's not that way.
They're rich when it comes to the amount of money they can spend to fight us. They just got money and we don't have that yet. All the money we spend on sporting goods and things, all that, you know, that all helps support the wildlife conservation efforts. We're actually paying for it, and they're taking all their money and spending it to fight us to end what we're doing.
That's what I don't understand is you and I pay for my kill tags. Well, kill tags are free for the most part, but we pay for our fur harvester's license. We pay for our deer licenses. We pay for, you know, my list of trap tags is a mile long. When I get a time, my wallet can't even hold on to them. Most of the time I have to put them somewhere. And then when I go target that animal, I have to go into the little vault, pull out, you know, what I need, and I go. But we pay for this stuff to keep our state land. I mean, that's what it goes for, is to pay for these things, and other people enjoy them, but they want us kicked out of there, and they don't want us to, basically they want us to pay, but they don't want us to do what we're paying for, is what it kind of puts out as. And it's kind of sad, you know. I'm having the issues around here. This is a whole separate issue, but, you know, on the state land, once November or October 15th starts and small game starts for us, the bike trails shut down, which is all on state land. But now the bike trails, they don't pay a fee, but now they still feel that they have the rights to be on there, even though it says they're shut down. It's the same concept. They want us to pay. They want to be able to still use it, but they don't want to have to pay to use what I paid for to use, you know.
Exactly.
That's one thing that I think I've seen a lot is, you know, one, it seems like they, when they attack, so to speak, it's from a emotional standpoint. Like Carl was explaining, and I'm sure you know too, Mark, I mean, our money goes towards outdoors. I mean, fees paid for hunting licenses. There's actually taxes on firearms that some of that money is allocated for that stuff. Hunters and outdoorsmen in general contribute more money to the preservation of these species than, you know, anybody, yet you don't hear them talking about that very much. You know, it's, they don't want people to know that. They just want to focus on the emotional side of all these poor fluffy animals are being abused. You know, it's,
yep, pull out the heartstrings. You know, right. Somebody's going to listen to that, and there's a lot of sportsmen that don't think you should have a contest, just a killing contest. Well, that's not what it is. It's just a competition. We're just doing the same thing we do anyway.
Right.
And, you know, just trying to make sure their talking points aren't valid. I mean, we're using the resource. We're protecting the sheep and the chickens. We're doing everything that we're doing anyway.
What I'd like to see is one of those antis put up with the stuff we go through on these contests. I mean, at the end of the contest, I really don't like myself for the most part. I'm so tired. I'm dragging. I've been through 25 mile an hour winds with snowstorms and sleet storms. And the next thing after this, and by the time Sunday rolls around, I'm just praying that I can find a place to take a nap somewhere. And you know what, that's, I'm not saying it's, I put myself through it, so it's my own doing, but by the end of it, boy, it's not as pretty as they think it is. And, you know, we're all frustrated with ourselves, but you look at all those animals and they get put down for the videos. They get put down ethically. They get shot, and the tournament kind of almost forces that because you need the numbers. So you're making sure that animal's down, that animal's done right now versus let's focus on the second one, because we got to make sure we have at least one in the truck. It kind of almost forces that for us. And yeah, that's kind of how we see it. At least I see it. I don't know.
Yeah,
Kevin, if you feel the same way.
Absolutely. I mean, especially when we're running the tournament, we usually come to an agreement beforehand that, you know, if we have to, we have multiple shooters on one animal, make sure we get it down. You know, we don't want a runner. We don't want to track one. We don't want just a wounded one. We want that animal down. We want it in the truck. So if it takes having, you know, two team members or three team members, everyone shooting at the same animal to get it down, that's what we do. I mean, hopefully you don't, especially the ammo prices the way they are, but it's still that focus of trying to make sure that you get it.
And, you know, just like I say, trying to show what we do in the proper light. There's a lot of debate about what people should post and shouldn't post on like Facebook sites, you know, Dispatch and photos. Some people want to show pictures. Maybe they shouldn't. Some people think they should. Some people think they should. And I just wish everybody would just use their best judgment when it comes to that.
Right.
We don't have to show everything we're doing. I'm doing things right, but I don't need to show myself killing the coyote up close, right? I don't need to just show that. Well, what is the point? I want the beautiful picture of the coyote and not maybe me holding it. But I try not to do that just because I don't want them to take that and use that video or something in the wrong context.
Yeah.
They do. Facebook in general. I'm the admin of the page for the NPDCA, and I have people trying to get on the page that don't have their stuff set to public. I can't tell who they are, and I do a little bit of research, and, you know, the wife's site is all full of animal rights stuff. I know that this guy's just trying to get on there to see what we're doing. You know, I'm not going to let people in there because I don't want that in there.
Right.
It's a nonstop battle.
And we deal with that a lot on our page, Overdrive Outdoors, especially, you know, and Carl's probably seen this too. Our biggest detractors are actually from other countries. We get so much, for lack of a better word, hate from people from other countries that it's crazy. You know, I mean, if we look at the analytics of our site, where the traffic comes from, I don't know if you've looked at it lately, Carl, but I mean, Pakistan, India, Spain, all these foreign countries. And a lot of those are the ones that give us the most grief for what we do. It really surprises me that we get more from other countries than we do from here in the U.S. I mean, we do get some in the U.S., but the biggest detractors are from other countries. But that's the thing about social media is it's worldwide. You know, it's not just local unless you somehow throttle it to be just that. One thing I've noticed too is a lot of other states have recently been coming under attack and passed laws actually banning trapping. Have you seen that attempt in Michigan?
They would love to do that today. The antis would love to see us do that. They haven't necessarily tried to ban trapping in general. I mean, there's been a lot of the conibear thing back in the day, trying to restrict it. You know that the antis love that. They want to restrict everything. But so far, they haven't hit a huge push to end trapping. I know, like New Jersey, if you possess a foothold trap in New Jersey, that's against the law.
Really?
Yeah. So if you're driving through there, you got a foothold trap, you're breaking the law.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
I've never heard that one before.
No, so they got some crazy laws out there, and they've been very successful at ending trapping in a lot of places. In Colorado, cage only. I mean, that California, we don't even need to talk about how crazy that is.
Right.
I mean, they stopped the trapping there, and then now they got the coyote problem. And what do we do about this coyote problem? No.
And that's something I talked about in one of the other podcasts we did with Chris Yazzie, who lives in New Mexico. When I was out in SHOT Show in Las Vegas recently, I had several people from that area come up and tell me that they had stopped trapping of, for example, mountain lions in certain areas. Well, now they have mountain lions roaming around in town and it's becoming a problem and they don't know what to do about it. It was like, well, you know, you have a tool available to you in the sportsmen that want to pursue that animal, but you just shut them off. So what did you expect? You know,
a lot of people don't, people who aren't around outdoors, outdoors women, don't realize people even trap. I can't tell you how many people say, "You still do that?" I say, "Yeah, I do that a lot." And that's where, like at the Legislative Sportsman's Caucus breakfast I was telling you about, you know, I'm walking through the aisle talking, doing my presentation. I got the coyote trap set, and I just put my hand in it right in mid sentence. And I keep talking with that hanging on my hand. I got to put down on the ground and take my feet to take it off my hand. I just keep talking the entire time. And that does wonders for them understanding what I'm talking about. When they see that and they understand, that's not designed to hurt the animal. That's designed to hold them.
And, right.
And until you can get that message across, they're looking at it from the other side. They don't know.
Well, not only that, but the aspect of, you know, the fact that the trap only holds the animal, but also the fact that you have to check that trap every 24 hours down here.
Correct.
You know, it's not like you're leaving that animal there for days at a time or weeks at a time. That by law has to be checked every 24 hours. And I don't think a lot of people know that.
When I catch the stray dog and I take the trap off their foot and I send them on their way, or even like the female fox I caught this year, I let her out of the trap and just let her run off into the bushes, you know.
And
I don't know. They don't realize that you can do that.
And that's something that I've actually had people over here that ask me about that. And I'll pull up a video and show them of a release. And I said, you watch this. They're going to go up and they're going to release the animal. And you'll watch that animal just run off. I mean, it might limp a little bit, but it's perfectly healthy. You know, he runs off and he's going to live another day. And unless he gets caught in another trap by someone that can actually take him, I mean, they really aren't harmed by it.
Oh, I actually was trapping a piece of property, and I actually trapped the landowner's dog. And the landowner happened to, where'd my dog go? You know, the dog's been missing for a little bit, so he went out looking, and sure enough, there's the dog in the trap. And the dog wasn't happy. You know, what dog is happy when they're confined to being stuck in one little spot? And they didn't know what to do, and they fumbled with it, and they called me, how do I get my dog out of the trap? And I explained to them how to get it out, and 2 seconds later, the dog's out of the trap. Well, sure, the dog limped for 2 seconds, and then they never had another issue. They never had a cut. They never had any issues. You know, like, they didn't have to go to the vet. They didn't have any bills. And the dog was in there for probably an hour, you know, but there was no issues. That's what these traps are designed to do, is to hold them, to preserve the fur, because that's the point of taking these animals outside of, you know, predator conservation and doing what we need to do to animal wildlife conservation. But it's designed to keep these animals safe. You know, that we don't want to hurt them until it's time to take them. You know, we don't want to just start wounding animals. That's why me personally, probably shouldn't say this, but I don't like the Michigan legal snares. It doesn't kill the animal, and it just hurts them. That's, to me, it's something I don't like. That's why I went away from snares. I get the theory behind it. You can't get deer and you can't hurt them. You know, there's a breakaway, but there's a purpose for it. And that's why they put those in place. But I personally, you know, the footholds and the conibears, that's honestly where it's at. It's designed to either dispatch the animal now or to make sure that animal is not harmed to the point of, if you do release them, they are, you know, not able to go back to being a natural animal back into the wild. A little smarter, well, actually a lot smarter. They become quite harder to trap again, I'll tell you what. But especially those pesky beavers, they get pretty trap shy pretty quick.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. So if someone wants to join MTCPA and be part of the organization and help the fight for everything that we do, what's the best route for them to do that, Mark?
The website, MTPCA website, MTPCA.com, I believe. That's what it is. I have to look at myself to make sure. But just Google MTPCA, Michigan Trapper and Predator Powers Association, or the website, and go right there on the square site and sign up.
And if you want to go to a convention, oftentimes you can sign up at a convention if you want to go there, right?
Yes, and we do a lot of sports shows. We did the Delta Flex show in Grand Rapids there a couple weeks ago. We had a booth set up there, and we were signing people up. And, you know, we have a raffle every year and stuff. So pretty decent-sized raffle.
We wanted to try and be there for that, but it was the same weekend as a tournament.
Yeah, exactly. So, like I said, that's the best way to do that.
So you said there's one more fur sale in Gaylord, you said?
Gaylord, yes.
Okay.
Yep, for sure.
And when is that?
It's in March.
Okay.
I have to look at the website. I don't want to give the wrong date here. Okay, March 26th.
And when does that typically, what times does that run? What time does that start?
Auctioneer starts at 9 a.m.
Okay.
I'll get there before 9 if you want to bring some fur up there. There will be people there to help if you have any questions. And it's just a good way. If you want to see what put up fur looks like, that's a good place to go and look. That's how I learned how to put up fur, by going there and seeing what it looks like. And I see the guy that's getting $1 for his muskrats and the guy that's getting 4. What's the difference in the fur? Okay. He's doing this, you know, I can look at the difference in person and see that. It's exciting having the auctioneer going all the time.
I know a lot of the guys too, they typically are there to help you, right? Like if you have questions, there's people there that'll help you answer some of the, I mean, they're not going to tell you do this, but they'll help you. Is that?
Yes, they will. There's been a lot of people help me there. Everybody there that's selling fur, you know, once they're done, they're getting their fur with tags on it, they'll talk to you about where they've got on the table. They're proud of it. That's their work right there. It's the last time they're going to see it. You know, they're pretty proud of it. And they'll tell you about it, tell you how they did it and what they did. I've been able to talk to the buyers too. You know, would you rather I did this or did that? You know, so I can get the advice from the people who are buying the fur too.
But if it helps you, you know, gain an extra few dollars out of your fur, why wouldn't you? You know, if especially if they're willing to give you the tips to figure out how to get the money out of what you're trying to do.
That's one thing that our local fur buyer here, Rick Ingalls, I mean, he actually taught me a lot about what he looks for as a buyer in terms of like coyote furs, you know, looking for the white belly fur, you know, consistent gray color tends to sell the best. I mean, that actually is pretty good information for someone that wants to sell the fur as to what they're looking for and what they'll pay the most for.
And for the upcoming competition this weekend, Rick couldn't be there, I guess, at the sale, or he couldn't be there by, and that Trevor Barnes is going to be out of town. I believe there's a gentleman going to be there still going to buy, and he buys a lot of stuff for the skulls. There's a market for skulls and bones and things like that people can utilize out of an animal. And so I think that there's going to be someone there interested in that part of it.
That would be more interesting because I've heard there's a lot of people like to buy skulls, teeth, stuff like that. But I have yet to really run into anyone that has said, yeah, give them to me. You know, other than the guy that I have that does beetles for skulls. And when he runs low on deer, he's like, bring me some coyotes. So yeah. Take him some coyotes and, you know, help keep his beetles fed. But other than that, I haven't run into anybody personally in this area that wants them. So that's interesting to know. I'll have to see if we can figure out who that is and what they're looking for.
Yeah, I don't have his name, but he should be there at the Jays on Sunday, but I believe.
Okay.
I'm curious who that is. I know some just south of you, Kevin, is my buddy Luke Walker. He runs Walker Skulls.
Yep.
And that's what he does is, again, it's a side job, but it's talking to him. It's actually becoming to the point of, oh crap, I might need to actually start turning this into a business. Because he works on the side, but I actually collect a bunch of skulls in that last tournament. That's what I did I had a buddy that wanted to learn how to tan and skin. So I collected all the coyotes that nobody wanted. He practiced on skinning these animals. And now he has all the skulls that I'm taking over to Luke so that he can continue feeding his beetles in the summertime when he starts running out of work. And then he can keep his beetle colony growing and get ready for all the deer that typically come in and all the other neat animals that are in there. So,
yeah. So the people going to the competition, I recommend that if you get there and after the competition, if someone's not buying your fur, take it back home with you, process it, find out a way to dispose of it yourself. The last thing I'd want to see is a pile of bloody coyotes laying there, not getting used, because there will be people there watching. There will be somebody there, I'm sure, taking video and use it on the internet.
Right. I'm sure this time of year, we're going to see a lot of rubbed up coyotes. At least I've been seeing them. I know Josh was still a pretty nice female, but across the board, we're seeing a lot more rubbed up, you know, a little bit of mange, but more rubbed females because of breeding season happening now. And so a lot of people are going to say, well, I don't really feel like doing anything with it. Well, like you were saying, there's someone that's going to buy a skull. Even if he gives you $2, there's $2 right there that you're starting to utilize the animal. I know a lot of the fur lure makers, they'll buy the coyotes or look to get the coyotes for the glands. They're trying to make baits and lures off of it. There's always a utilization of this animal. I know we don't eat them. I know Kevin has.
Josh,
that's something else. I'll tell you what.
You know, too, it's nice we have a contact up here of a lady that actually will buy almost every tan fur we can get her because she makes hats and gloves out of them. And then she sells them at a store here in Muskegon. And I know she spends a fair amount of money with Rick, and then all the ones that we get tanned up, she buys from us as well too. So that's another avenue that we see them go, which goes back to what you were saying earlier, you know, people getting into the craft business with them.
Certainly. Yeah, utilize them first. That's a big part of it.
Yep.
I know too, there's a lot of in the market now, you know, we have like you and I, Kevin, and a lot of other of us, we call them, we hunt them, we do it this way, but, and I hunt solo. I know you hunted last night solo, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I know a lot of people too are starting to get into the dad doing something with his son on the weekends. It gives them something to do out in the wild, to go do something, to see it. And I know right now coming up is spring beaver. That starts here. I mean, technically now, but spring beaver starts here in the next 2 weeks. That's another great thing for people to get out in the woods. Try trapping a beaver. You know, anybody can trap those kits, but you get an adult going, boy, you better get on those runs. It makes it pretty fun and challenging, just like chasing that one big buck. You're trying to get that one big beaver, and he's already seen the traps. He's already seen this whole thing work. So now you're trying to figure out how to outsmart him before he knows what's happening. And I don't know. I enjoy doing that. I don't know. I'm assuming you as well, Mark, try to have fun doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I enjoyed a lot.
I've heard beaver stew is really good. I missed out on a chance to try it, but I've heard it's really good too. Have either one of you guys done that?
I'd never made stew, but I put them on the grill.
Really?
While I'm still, they're cooking while I'm still putting up beaver.
Yeah, I fry them. I pan fry the back straps, the thighs. That's where most of your meat's going to come from, is your back straps and your thighs. And you got your front shoulders too. But I don't know. It's a pretty good meat. I like it. I've put it up against a farmer and beef, and he actually picked the beaver over the beef. He thought he had it figured out, and I gotcha. You know, this is what I'm picking. And sure enough, I said, nope. And he said, no, you're lying to me. So I cooked him up side by side to see, and he goes, holy crap, you're right. You're not kidding. And I said, yeah, it's a pretty good piece of meat. That's underutilized in my opinion, but I enjoy eating it.
Is the tail edible?
People can eat it, but I'm not eating it.
I saw, what was show was that? The Mountain Man, or the one where they're up in Alaska, Life Below Zero or whatever. And one of the ladies, she was pregnant, and she said she was craving the tail.
Really?
And so they cut it open, and it's all gristle. Like a cartilage kind of thing. And apparently she craved it during her pregnancy, so she had it. But that's at least what I was told, is that. Have you ever tried it, Mark, or no?
I've never tried it. I've had hundreds of beaver tails in my hand, and I've never said, man, I got to eat that. I've watched them on TV before, and, you know, it's edible. I wouldn't starve to death if I had that there, but I'm not going to go to the trouble to cook the tail with gristle.
Actually, I was talking to a guy. He was telling me that they actually take the beaver tail gristle, and they use it for ice fishing. They take a little bit of that gristle and cut it out and put it on their teardrop, and they jig bluegills with it. And they said it's actually a really good bluegill bait for ice fishing, and I never would have guessed it, but
the lady,
she wanted them, and I said, oh, you can have them. I don't have anybody buying them right now. I was actually shipping them to Oklahoma to my buddy, just have them for free. I have so many in the freezer right now, and he was happy because he makes tail oil out of it for trapping.
Tail oil?
Yeah. Is that, you never heard of tail oil?
No. Is that a lure then?
Go ahead, Mark, if you want to explain it.
Yeah, I mean, you just render it down, and all that fat turns into the liquid. I mean, just leave it out there.
And it's used as a lure.
So what you do is you take the tail and you cut it into chunks. It's the best way to do it. You put it in a jar with a lid that has for the gases to escape. And you leave it. I leave it in the sun. Some people leave it in the ground for a year or two. And it actually, you're laughing, but it actually has a really sweet smell. It does not smell rotten. It doesn't smell gross in any way, shape, or form. And then what happens is, because you leave the tail, the black part and the gristle on there, and then you'll see a black tar floating on the top of all the mushy junk on the bottom, and you siphon that black stuff off, and then you actually use that as a lure, just like you do any other lure you buy in the store. Just like they use, you probably haven't heard of this one, but horse hoof. They do the same thing with horse hoofs. They cut the nails off them and put them in a jar and do the same thing. And actually that's another lure that they use.
I know with beaver, one of the more valuable things on the trapping market is beaver caster. And it's amazing how many things that caster is used in. I mean, perfume, food, I mean, all kinds of stuff.
New car smell. A lot of people don't realize what that's actually used in. And if you see natural in your food, it says natural ingredients, and there's vanilla or strawberry. It's not vanilla or strawberry, I promise you that. It's beaver butt, but I know Mark here, he made some beaver butt beer, right?
Yes, I did. I brewed beer with beaver caster in it.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, I gotta ask, what it tastes like?
Tasted like beer with beaver caster. No, it was just a hint. It was just, I didn't use very much, but it was in there. And I got some, food grade beaver caster. A lot of times they'll tincture it in like a rubbing alcohol or some kind of alcohol for use in perfumes. Well, this was like tinctured in like a liquid alcohol, like a Everclear or something like that.
And this is how I met Mark. And sure enough, I couldn't believe it. We were walking around that convention, and I don't know how many people walked up and asked you if you had any more of that beer. They were actually asking for more of it because they actually enjoyed the flavor of it. And I was blown away. Like, you got to be joking, right? Like, these people are just messing with me. And they looked at me like I was some kind of jerk for thinking it was crazy. And they, but sure enough, everybody liked it.
Yeah, it was well done.
But you say it tastes like beaver caster, a hint of beaver caster. What is that flavor? Is it like a vanilla?
No, it's really nothing like that. I mean, that's actually what I thought it might be like if I put it in there, and it didn't turn out that way. But it's got this certain aroma you have with caster. And once you know it's there, you can pick it out. But someone else may not know what that flavor is. I mean, if you tried it and you don't know what beaver caster smells like, you might not be able to pick it out.
Okay.
It's kind of like, Kevin, how many times have you walked in the woods with somebody and you said, oh, Fox has been here?
Right.
And then everyone's like, how do you know that? And you can pick it up, and they're like, it's kind of the same concept. As soon as you smell that beaver caster, it's like, yep, we're in business here.
Yeah. I mean, there's been times too where I shot a coyote and I was trying to find it in thick grass, and you get downwind and you're like, yep, there that coyote's around here somewhere. Start following your nose back towards where the wind's coming from, and eventually you find that coyote.
Yep, probably, perfect man.
Hopefully it probably smells better than coyote does, though.
Oh, yeah. I really like the smell.
I do, too. I really enjoy the smell of beaver caster. Every time I go to a new landowner that has me come in and trap for them, they always want to walk the line with me the first time. And I say, yeah, come on, you know, come along with me. Let's see what I caught. Let's see how bad of a trapper I am today or yesterday, you know. And so we walked the line, and sure enough, you know, typically the first check, you always hit quite a few beaver on the first check because they don't see it coming. And I always say, hey, have you ever smelled beaver caster? And they say, no. And sure enough, that's the first thing I do is I get it to excrete a little bit of caster and I have them smell it. And they're always looking at me like, you're going to have me smell beaver butt. And I'm like, it's not beaver butt. I promise you, it doesn't. No, you're not going to get me to smell the butt of a beaver, you know. And no. Try this one time, you know. And all right, you know, finally I convince them. And then they go, wow, that actually is not what I was expecting of a smell. And then it kind of, they almost seem to trust you more. Like, okay, you're not trying to get me to smell the butthole of an animal. You know, and I said, no, it's just a more unique smell. And what most people don't realize is that's how they distinguish each other. So like you can, one trick I was told is you can actually trap the female or the male, vice versa, and of the parents, and you keep that beaver caster set aside, keep trapping. And when you get stuck with that last adult that you can't get, you just are like, man, this bugger's got me figured out. I take a little bit of that caster of its mate and I'll put that out there. I'll make a little bit of a concoction and I'll put that out there. Well, then they think, man, my lady or my guy's back here. Maybe they went and checked out another pond. So then they come in to check it out. Typically then you can get it. But they can actually distinguish each one as a, we can't distinguish it, but they can distinguish each one as a individual smell, and it's kind of unique. So
are beavers the only animal that has a caster like that? Do muskrats have that?
They have glands, but not a caster gland.
Okay.
They have, especially right now, it's swollen. The muskrats do. It starts as breeding season starts coming, they get these glands too in that same general area. And from what I was told, and some of the fur buyers were telling me that they actually use that and they keep it and they make a concoction that they use for muskrats. I always figured you just trap muskrats as these dumb rats are running around. And why try to go the route of trying to do the beaver style where you can just pick them up in the runs and the food habits. But
at our last first sale, we had a guy sell some muskrat glands. And they sold caster there too. You can sell caster at the for sale, but
most you can or cannot?
You can, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, just curious, how much did he sell and how much money did he actually get for that muskrat?
I don't know. I was busy working. I just see him go through the table. I didn't see what the price was. But I'm sure it's not very much for them. The caster goes pretty high, though. Caster, I mean, they sell by the pound.
And that was going, last I knew, for about $60 a pound?
Yeah, that sounds right. I've seen it as high as 80 before, seen as low as 30. But
a lot of people don't realize caster, there's grades, and I don't remember how many grades there are. You could probably help me with this, Mark, but there's grade A, which is typically your adults, your 40 pounders and up. And then you have your grades 2, 3, BCs, 2, 3s and 4s down. And a lot of your kits, your younger beavers are going to be way on the bottom end, and that isn't going to pull you the numbers, the $60 a pound. It's going to be way down on, and I don't know how, $5 we could even say a pound, because there's not a lot of caster actually in the sack, where your grade A's are going to be more on the, you know, your adults, you're going to see probably more in the males. And those are going to be bigger, fuller casters. And then they're actually getting a product versus, like I said, the kits don't really have, when you open the kits up, it's, you see the sacks, but there ain't anything in there. Yeah, you still take it, but.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Mark. And again, for our listeners out there, I encourage you to check out the Michigan Trappers and Predator Callers Association, MTCPA. I know they're on Facebook, also on a website. Are you on any other medias?
No.
Okay. So check them out on their website or Facebook. Encourage people to join up. You know, help support your fellow sportsmen that are trappers and predator callers. Get in the fight, basically, to help preserve our rights and the way of life that we have here for those hobbies. So once again, thank you, Mark, and thank you, Carl, for joining us. And we will talk to you again soon.
Thank you.